Beloved Bhagwan, on one occasion, Hayakujo said, if we are attached to a viewpoint that we are naturally the Buddhas and that we are in Zen Buddhism because we are originally pure and enlightened, we are among non-Buddhists who deny causality. At another time, a Vinaya master named Yuan once came to Hayakujo and asked, do you make efforts in your practice of the Tao, master? Hayakujo replied, yes, I do. When hungry, I eat. When tired, I sleep. Yuan asked, and does everybody make the same efforts as you do, master? Hayakujo answered, not in the same way. When they are eating, they think of 100 kinds of necessities, and when they are going to sleep, they ponder over affairs of 1,000 different kinds. That is how they differ from me. At this, the Vinaya master was silenced. On another occasion, the Venerable Tao Kuan asked Hayakujo, master, what mental processes do you employ in pursuing the Tao? Hayakujo answered, I have no mental processes that would be of use and no Tao to follow. Tao Kung asked, if both those statements are true, why is it that every day you convene gatherings during which you urge others to learn how to follow the Tao by means of Zen? Hayakujo said, this old monk does not possess even a dot of ground in which to stick an awl. Why, master, you are lying to my face, exclaimed Tao Kung. Hayakujo replied, how can this old monk, being without tongue to urge people, tell a lie? I do not understand the way the Venerable Zen Master talks, said Tao Kung. Whereupon Hayakujo said, nor does this old monk understand himself.
Manisa. This series of talks is entitled The Great Pearl. Hyakujo with the haikus of Basu. Hyakujo is immensely expressive and knows what he is doing and how to bring people to the unknowable. Basu never wrote prose. Basu is one of the greatest poets in the world. His greatness is not in his poetry. There are far greater poets as far as the composition of poetry is concerned. His greatness is that his poetry is not just verbiage. It is not just putting words together according to a certain pattern. His poetry is an experience. I have put them together because Hyakujo never wrote any poetry. His approach is very prose and direct. And with the haikus to supplement what is missing in the prose. Basu expressed himself into very graphically. His experiences are more paintings than poetries. And his understanding is, and I agree with him, that where prose fails, poetry may succeed. Because poetry has a more feminine way, more subtle, more graceful, entering into the heart. Prose directly enters into the head, immediately becomes a concern of logic and reason. Poetry has a different route, a different path. You don't bring rationalization as far as poetry is concerned. Something else becomes stirred in you. Something deeper than the mind. Because poetry cannot be a logical statement. It is an existential statement. What Basu has seen himself, he has tried to put into words. Hence, I have put together two great masters, the name The Great Pearl is Hayakuju's old name in Chinese . His childhood name was Chu, and Chu means pearl. I have put the series The Great Pearl. Both are Himalayan peaks, and together they are going to create a tremendous harmony. What prose can say, very straightforward. The poetry cannot say that in that straightforward manner. But there is much that is left out. Poetry can pick up the left out, because it has no obligation to any logic, no obligation to any grammar, no obligation to any formulation. It has a certain freedom which prose has not. So it can say things which prose will become embarrassed to say. The Great Pearl applies to both. They both are the most beautiful Zen masters. Before I discuss Hayakuju's and Basho's sutras, yesterday I introduced you with the biographical note on Hayakuju. Today I want to introduce you the biography of Basho. The Japanese haiku poet Basho was born in 1644, the son of a samurai in the service of the Lord of Yuno Castle. As a young boy, Basho became the page and steady companion of the nobleman's eldest son, and together they learned, among other skills, the art of making verse. On the death of his master, Basho went to Edo, now Tokyo, where he studied verse under Kigen. He then became a disciple of the Zen master Buko. Basho's fame as a master poet spread. He began to attract disciples of his own. Journeying became Basho's lifestyle, providing him with a chance to observe and write of nature, with which he felt such a deep affinity. He once wrote, "All who achieve greatness in art possess one thing in common, they are one with nature. Whatever such a mind sees is a flower, and whatever such a mind dreams of is the moon. It is only a barbarous mind that sees other things than flowers, merely an animal mind that dreams of other than the moon. The flower and the moon are only symbolic. What he is intending to say is that the really silent mind can only see the greatest in existence, the most beautiful, the most truthful. He can see only flowers and moons. In his status, in his height, he cannot see mean and ugly things of which human mind is so much filled up. He calls this mind, which has not known the experience of emptiness, a barbarous mind. A beautiful definition of a barbarous mind. The mind of a Buddha will only see flowers all around. The mind of Buddha reclining will see moon and the stars and all that is beautiful in the darkness of the night, whether it is morning or evening, it does not matter. The no mind only reflects the most precious, and the so-called mind that we have is only concerned with the ugliest. It is barbarous. When Hayakujo returned to Yu Chao, he lived in a retired life. Concealing his abilities and outwardly appearing somewhat mad, it was at this time that he composed his Shastra, called a treatise setting forth the essential gateway to truth by means of instantaneous awakening. Later this book was stolen and brought to the Yangtze region and shown to Matazu. After reading it carefully, Matazu declared to his disciples, "In Yu Chao there is now a great pearl. Its luster penetrates everywhere, freely and without obstruction." Matazu was making a pun on Hayakujo's original surname of Chu. Hayakujo was Matazu's disciple and finally his successor. Manisha has asked these sutras for today. Beloved Bhagwan, on one occasion Hayakujo said, "If we are attached to a viewpoint that we are naturally the Buddhas and that we are in Zen Buddhism because we are originally pure and enlightened, we are among non-Buddhists who deny causality." Now it is something to be understood. It is one of the most debated subject matter for centuries. If enlightenment is sudden, that means there is no cause to it. It can be sudden only if it has no causality. If it has any cause, then first the cause has to be produced, then enlightenment will follow. Science believes in causality. You provide all necessary causes, and this will be the inevitable outcome. But Zen, in the sense of sudden enlightenment, drops the idea of causality. There is no cause that leads to enlightenment. And Hayakujo is making it clear if no cause, no causality leads to enlightenment, the reason is because enlightenment is not an effect. Cause and effect are joined together. Enlightenment is not an effect of any cause. It is already there. The effect is in the future. That which is already there needs no cause. It needs only a turning of your vision. That is not a cause. It needs only a remembrance. That is not a cause. What is already there in this very moment requires no causality. Causality produces something. It is already perfectly present. Nothing has to be added. All that is needed is to wake up and see. Seeing is not a causality. You have to understand it. That's why no method, no device can be said to be absolutely certain to lead you to enlightenment. All that it can do, it can trigger a certain process in you so that you start looking inwards. It can produce the looking inwards, but it cannot produce your enlightenment. If you honestly and urgently look inwards, the Buddha is there. Your enlightenment explodes in thousands of ways. It has been just waiting for your eyes. But all Zen masters have been talking about methods, about devices. The reason is that there is no way to introduce you to your own Buddha, your own nature. It is so deep down inside you, it cannot be made objective. It cannot be said, look, this is your nature. Say hello to it. Get introduced. Nobody can introduce you to your own nature. Hence all these devices, which are in a way lies, but desperate efforts of the masters somehow to force you to look inwards, then everything will happen on its own accord. A Vinaya master, Vinaya is the whole Buddhist scripture, named one once came to Hayakujo and asked, do you make efforts in your practice of the Tao, Master? Hayakujo replied, yes, I do. When hungry, I eat. When tired, I sleep. Such a great and beautiful statement contains so much oceans of meaning. Yes, I do, says Hayakujo. When hungry, I eat. When tired, I sleep. He is saying, I simply go with the nature. I am no more, only nature is. Tired, it goes to sleep. Hungry, it eats. Neither I interfere, nor I make any effort in the sense effort is understood. Yuan asked a necessary question. And does everybody make the same efforts as you do, Master? Hayakujo answered, not in the same way. When they are eating, they think of 100 kinds of necessities. And when they are going to sleep, they ponder over affairs of 1,000 different kinds. That is how they differ from me. A clear-cut differentiation. If you can understand this, you will understand the difference with a Buddha who looks almost human and between other human beings. Their actions are the same. The Buddha eats when he is hungry. He sleeps when he feels tired. So you do. On the surface, there seems to be no difference. The difference is inside. When Buddha is eating, he is simply eating. There are no other thoughts in the sky of his mind. His whole attention, his whole awareness is just concerned with the act in the present, eating. When he is asleep, he is simply asleep. He does not dream. He does not wander here and there. Thousand anxieties and problems, he has none. Asleep, he is simply asleep. Modern psychoanalysis has to come to an understanding. They have not yet dared. They have only been studying what Hayakuju calls the barbarous mind. Their all conclusions and their whole science will remain absolutely incomplete unless they explore the mind of a Buddha. That will bring a tremendous revolution in the whole psychoanalytical movement. Because on the surface the Buddha is exactly the same as you are. But you can see the point, while you are eating, you are thinking thousand and one thoughts. While you are sleeping, you are dreaming of faraway lands, or maybe repressed desires. It is said that even while you are making such a deep and intimate act as love, you are not loving the woman you are making love to. You are thinking of Sophia Loren. And don't think that it is only you who are thinking of Sophia Loren. The woman you are making love, she is thinking of Muhammad Ali. On every bed there are four fellows. This is the barbarous mind. Never in the moment, always going astray. Hayakuju make the enlightened man's difference very clearly. When hungry, eat. When tired, sleep. Don't do anything else. Always remain contained in the moment. Contained in the act, raising hands, just raise your hand. Don't think of anything else. Sitting, just sit. Walking, just walk. Every act should be so concentrated that it does not allow other thoughts to enter in. A simple understanding of this can make one a Buddha. because this will bring your whole consciousness together to such a point that it becomes almost an arrow. And whenever your consciousness becomes an arrow, it starts moving towards the origin of your life. All devices are just to make your consciousness an arrow, and with an urgency, so that it moves. You are not far away. It is just a small journey. But it takes people millions of lives to fulfill it, because they never move even an inch inwards. And when these barbarous minds are going to sleep, they ponder over affairs of a thousand different kinds. That's how they differ from me. At this, the Vinaya master was silenced. He was only a scholar. He had no idea of the inner world. He has absolute control of the outer objective philosophical concepts, but he has no idea at all from where his life arises, from where his consciousness arises, where are the roots of his very being. He was completely silenced by the master. He could not utter a single word, but he could not become enlightened either. He could not ask anything more. He could not answer the master. He was simply became silent, knowing that he is entering in an unknown territory. He knows perfectly well the shastras, the scriptures, but he does not know anything about this eating, eat, walking, walk, sitting, sit. This is the problem with the scholars, how they go on missing the authentic master. They come to understand, but they come to understand the world, not the experience. At this, the Vinaya master was silenced. On another occasion, the venerable Tao Kuang asked Hayakujo, "Master, what mental processes do you employ in pursuing the Tao?" Hayakujo answered, "I have no mental processes that would be of use, and no Tao to follow." This is the ultimate statement of a witness. There are no mental processes. He has left the mind far behind, and there is no goal of Tao or Dhamma. He himself is the goal. He is the Buddha. He is Tao. He is Dhamma. He is the truth itself. Now there is no question of any mental processes or any goal of Tao. Tao Kuang asked, if both those statements are true, why is it that every day you convene gatherings during which you urge others to learn how to follow the Tao by means of Zen? That is the way how intellectuals function. He has not understood Hayakujo's great statement. He has simply analyzed it and found that there is a contradiction. That this man says there is no mental processes that would be of any use, and there is no Tao to follow. If this is true, then why this man goes on teaching great assemblies . You have to see how intellectuals function and how they miss. He asked him, if these both things are true as you say, why is it that every day you convene gatherings during which you urge others to learn how to follow the Tao by means of Zen? That can be asked to any master. Even the master himself is very much concerned. I have told you, Gautam Buddha did not speak for 7 days after his enlightenment. When asked, he said, I have been pondering for 7 days whether to speak or not, and I cannot find any reason to speak. There are no means that I can teach to people that will lead them inevitably to enlightenment. There is no goal to be achieved so people can be shown the path. And people want some understanding what discipline has to be done, what cause is going to produce Buddhahood. There is no cause. So I have been wondering all these 7 days that whatever I say will not be exactly true. Should I say it or keep quiet? To be silent seems to be more honest and more truthful, but a little unkind. Unkind to those who are still staggering in darkness. Unkind to those who are very close to the source, just a little help, a little push may make them Buddhas. But it is not so easy. If you push somebody, he becomes angry. Your push is not necessarily to be understood as a compassion. The person may become more ugly than he was by or puss. He may become more barbarous. He may stand up to fight with you. That why you pushed me? Why you said this? Why you exposed me? So the work of the master is not just full of roses. It is one of the most delicate work of art to help a man to become a Buddha. A slight mistake and everything is spoiled. And the problem is not of the master. The problem is of the disciple. How the disciple is going to take your word, is not within your control. So Buddha said, I am thinking not to speak at all. Those who are capable of becoming Buddhas will become Buddhas a little late. Perhaps. And those who are too much involved in darkness and mundane activities are not going to listen to me. They will simply waste my time and will be angry at me that I am wasting their time. But the people who were urging him, they said, you are 99.9% right. But please think of 0.1%. You may fail with 99.9% people, but you may pass, succeed in helping one person out of 100 to become a Buddha. This is such a great event that those failures can be simply forgotten. They don't matter. Anyway, they were not going to become Buddhas. You need not be worried about them. But think of that 0.1%. You will be very unkind to those who are just on the periphery, a little puss, a little kindly word. That gives them a sense of urgency. A little look in their eyes that gives them the depth that they also contain, a little touch of love. The warmth of a Buddha, just his gesture, and Buddha agrees. His agreement is one of the greatest agreement that has been done in the human history. He could have disagreed. There was no way to force him. But then something great would have been completely forgotten. At least it is remembered here and there. Some people still become Buddhas, still reach to the same heights, because they know somebody has already traveled the path. And if one man is capable of becoming a Buddha, then there is no reason why I cannot become a Buddha. This gives a great courage and great encouragement. But the intellectual mind, not understanding the inner process of enlightenment, non-causal, non-logical, they immediately jump to the conclusion that there is a contradiction. Here you are saying that there is no mental processes which are of any use. By your mind, you cannot reach Buddhahood. You will have to drop the mind. So what is the use of mental processes? Mind as a whole entity has to be pushed aside so that you can see clearly and directly without any thoughts gathering in front of your eyes. And there is no goal. The moment you find utter silence and a deep understanding of yourself, your roots, you simply have a laugh, just a laugh, that I have been searching for the person who is hiding behind me, inside me, at my very center. But he immediately asked that there is a contradiction, because you teach people to meditate, you teach people certain devices. What is the point? Hayakuju said, this old monk does not possess even a dot of ground in which to stick an awl. He is saying he does not possess any mind to answer and satisfy your contradiction. Why, Master, you are lying to my face, exclaimed Tao Kuan. That is an eternal problem. The master has to lie. And if you think only of his lying, you will never understand that he was lying out of compassion. And those lies were just preparing a ground for you to take a jump in. I will tell you an old story. A king was very much interested in a young man who always remained underneath a tree, sitting silently. Even though the king every night passed around the city in disguise to look whether everything is right or not, he found that young man always sitting like a statue, without any movement. Finally, he could not contain his curiosity. He stopped his horse and he said, "Young man, forgive me to disturb your meditation. The young man opened his eyes and he said, "There is no need for any apology because I am not meditating. I am meditation. Nobody can disturb it. But whatever your curiosity is, please fulfill it." The king said, "I would love you to come to my palace. I will take care of you. There is no need to sit under this tree. Seeing you so silently, like the ancient story of Buddha, I have fallen in love with your silence, your gesture, your utter undisturbance. I invite you to come with me to my palace. I am the king." This is how the barbarous mind functions. He is asking him to come to his palace, inviting him. But deep down, his unconscious wants him not to accept his invitation, because that will mean he is still desirous of luxuries and palaces. But that young man simply stood up and he said, "I am coming." Immediately the whole scene changed. The mind of the king, that what I have done. This man is still interested in the luxuries of palace, being a guest of the king. This is not a great saint. This is the old idea of the saint, that he should be as uncomfortable as possible. Uncomfort is religion. Sick, hungry, torturing oneself in thousands of ways, and then you become a great saint. This fellow suddenly has fallen from his sainthood in the mind of the king. But now it was too late. He could not take his word back. It will be too ungentlemanly. But the young man was watching everything. He didn't say anything. The king provided him the best part of the palace, servants, young girls to look after him, and he accepted everything. And each acceptance, he was falling down in the scale of saintliness. What kind of saint he is? He accepted a beautiful king-size bed. He accepted all the delicacies of the palace. The king said, "My God, what kind of a stupid I am. This man deceived me. It seems he used to fetch me. Just sitting there every night because he knew I passed at that time. Sitting silently like a Buddha. He knew that I will be caught. And he caught me. And now it is very difficult either to swallow him or to spit him out. He is inside the palace." But how long you can carry such a state of mind? After 6 months, the king said to him one day early in the morning when they were taking a walk together in the gardens, that one question has been continuously harassing me and I want to get rid of it. Because of it, for 6 months I have not slept well. The young man said, "Any question you can ask." The king said, "It hurts me to ask, but I want to know what is the difference between me and you." You live in the palace, you enjoy all the luxuries. What is the difference between me and you?" The young man said, "I knew that this question is going to arise one day. In fact, it has arisen the same moment I had stood up to follow you. You are not a very courageous man. You should have asked immediately. Why waste 6 months? And for 6 months unnecessarily disturbing your sleep." "I can answer your question, but not here. You have to come with me outside the boundary of your kingdom." But it was not far away. Just the river, few miles away, was the boundary of his kingdom. The king said, "What is the need to go there? You can answer here." He said, "No, there is a need." Both went past the river. Standing on the other shore, the young man said, "My answer is that I am going ahead. Are you coming with me?" He said, "How I can come with you? I have a palace, I have a kingdom, I have my wife, my children. I have thousands of worries and problems to solve. How I can come with you?" The young man said, "Do you see the difference? I am going. I don't have any palace. I don't have any wife. I don't have any problems. I was as happy under my tree as I have been happy in your palace. Not a bit more or a bit less. My awareness is the same whether I am in a palace or in a forest." The king felt very sad at his ugly mind, that he thought such an ugly thing. He touched his feet and he said, "Forgive me. Even to think of this, I am fallen in my own eyes." The young man said, "No, don't do it. Because I have no difficulty seeing your tears and your touching my feet. I can come back. But you will still start thinking, 'My God, has he deceived me again?' I have no difficulty. But just not to be uncompassionate towards you, I will not come. Just let me go. The whole world is there. And I don't need much, just a tree to sit underneath. It does not matter to me at all." Now the king became more insistent, "No, you come back, otherwise I will be worried and hurt and wounded at what I have done." The man said, "You are putting me in difficulty. I can come, I am saying to you. But remember, you will again start thinking, 'What is the difference?' The barbarous mind only thinks of the meanness of the mediocrities. He does not have any heights to look at. Hayakujo replied, "How can this old monk, being without tongue, to urge people tell a lie?" Now the intellectual must have become even more suspicious. The old monk, Hayakuju, says, "How can this old monk, being without tongue," now this is apparently a lie, "without tongue to urge people to a lie?" But he is perfectly right. These are the worlds beyond our ordinary, mediocre lives. A man of enlightenment does not speak, he simply allows existence to speak through him. He does not see, he allows the Buddha inside him to see through his eyes. That's why once in a while somebody receptive enough can look in the eyes of the master, the eyes of a Buddha. He has no tongue of his own anymore. He has given everything to existence. He is no more in possession of the tongue, of the eyes, of the hands. Now whatever existence wants to do with him, he simply goes with it. His whole life is just a let go. But the intellectual will not understand. Now it is absolutely making a lie even more clear that I don't have any tongue, and he is speaking. And he is saying, how can I lie without a tongue? The problem for a master is, if he speaks, he defies the truth. However he tries, he cannot bring the truth into words. Just a little fragrance maybe, only for those who are intelligent enough to feel the difference. The same words are being used by a master as they are being used by you. But the master's words are not empty. Your words are empty. When you say to someone, I love you, you don't mean it. Perhaps it is a social custom. When a master says, I love you, his love is not an empty word. But you need to have great intelligence to figure out the fragrance that is carried by the words or the actions. And remember, to be intellectual does not mean to be intelligent. The intellectual is a great scholar. He knows much knowledge, but he may not be intelligent. And a man who knows nothing may be a farmer or a woodcutter or a fisherman, may have intelligence. He will not have intellectuality. He does not know anything about the intellectual world, but in his functioning, when Soviet Union came out of the revolution, the capital of the Tsars was Petrograd. It was not Moscow. Petrograd was made by one of the most barbarous men the world has known. Peter the Terrible. He was absolutely barbarous. He created Petrograd on his name and just because of his association, communists changed the capital to Moscow. But before changing it, it took years. They had to function in Petrograd. Just in front of the palace of the Tsar, there was a huge rock. That prevented anybody, any vehicle to pass before the front. It was consideredly kept there so that nobody passes and disturbs the Tsar. You can go on any other street, but you cannot move on the street before the palace. The rock was so huge that the communists were worried what to do with it. It has to be removed, but its largeness prevents all removal. They called architects and engineers, and they all thought about in many ways either to cut it into pieces, but that too was not easy. And they were all worried, and there was no solution coming out. And an old farmer was just leaning on his staff, standing there, looking with all these great engineers, architects, politicians. And when he saw that they are not being able to find any solution, he said, "I am just a farmer and I don't know anything. I don't know what engineering is and what architecture is. I have just heard these words here." But as I understand, you want to remove this rock. It is a very simple thing. Lenin himself asked him, "You say it is a very simple thing? Please tell us what is your idea." He says, "There is no idea. There is no need to remove the rock. Just dig around the rock and go on digging and taking out underneath the rock the mud, and then finally force the rock down so it becomes the part of the road." It was so simple and so intelligible that all those architects and engineers were at a loss, because they were thinking in conceptual terms in their books, in their university degrees, and this poor man had nothing but a practical intelligence. He said, "It is such a small thing. Just dig around the rock and then pull out as much mud as you can underneath the rock and then force the rock down. It will settle in the hole. Make the road, and it is such a beautiful rock, it should not be removed. And it will make such a beautiful part of the road in front of the palace. Exactly the farmer has been followed. The rock is still there before Petrograd's palace. Intelligence is a clarity, intellectuality is a borrowed knowledge. The intelligent person would not have said this to the master. That you are lying to my face. You tell people about devices and means, and to me you are saying there are no means and no devices. And there is no goal either. He could not rise to the height, and he could not understand the difficulty of a master. That he has to bring something from high peaks of experience to the marketplace. He has to use the same words. And he has in some way to create an urge, a longing. The very urge and longing is not there. Have you ever thought in your dreams that you want to become a Buddha? Have you ever wondered where is the source of your life? The master has to make goals for you, which are not goals. He has to tell you that it is a great pilgrimage to find the truth. You have to travel very far, and you have to discipline and cultivate yourself. Because the human mind is interested only in the difficult, it is not interested in the obvious and the simple. There are reasons why it is not interested in the obvious and the simple. The simple does not satisfy your ego. You will not go into the street shouting that I have just peeled a banana. Just. And I need my photograph in the newspaper. The first man who has peeled a banana. People will laugh at you that you are mad. You are yourself a banana. Small things, but when somebody goes to the Everest, the whole world becomes interested. All the news media, that the first man has reached on the Everest. The difficult is attractive because it gives you the ego. The simple is unattractive because you cannot claim an ego on its part. The master has to make a goal of Buddha, although he knows you are the Buddha. But he knows perfectly well that even if he tells you that you are the Buddha, you are not going to trust him. I tell you every day, you are the Buddha. Have you ever trusted me? Ananda, in her anger, sent a message to me that she is suspicious. Suspicious of what? Suspicious, certainly, about my provoking you to be a Buddha. I don't have anything else to do here. Suspicious about what? You are suspicious about your own potential, and I have to hammer it on your head continuously. So for this series, I have put the name of Nivedana's drum, Ananda. So he goes on hitting every day till she comes to her senses. Suspicious. But that is not only her problem. It is the problem of every intellectual. Ananda is a law graduate. I do not understand the way the venerable Zen master talks, said Tao Kung. You are speaking and you say that you don't have a tongue. You go on teaching about devices and goals and you say there are no mental activities of any use and there is no goal either. Whereupon Hayakujo said, nor does this old monk understand himself. He accepted that nor does he understand himself. Only existence knows what he is using me for. I am absolutely available to existence. If he wants to lie through me, I will lie. If he wants something else to be done through me, I will do. I have dropped myself completely into the hands of the cosmos. Hayakujo is saying something of tremendous importance. A master is absolutely absent as far as his individuality is concerned. He is absolutely present as far as his cosmic experience is concerned. And you need to have some intelligence, some heart, understand it. A haiku by Basu, mad with poetry, I stride like Chikusai into the wind. Chikusai was one of Basu's poet heroes of the past. Mad with poetry. If you are not mad, your poetry will be very poor. A poetry which is sane will be ordinary. Prosia, just composition of words without any essential meaning running through it. To be a poet is, in a certain sense, to be mad. Mad with poetry, I stride like Chikusa into the wind. It has not been recognized by the religions of the world. I want to make it an absolutely discontinuity with the past, in the sense that I don't consider the older saints to be authentically religious. They can be divided in two parts. Either they are masochists who enjoy in torturing themselves, or they are sadists who enjoy in teaching people to torture themselves, who enjoy others torturing, and it is possible one man may be both. He may enjoy torturing himself and he may enjoy torturing others. Most of the saints belong to psychologically sick people, and the real religious people have not been taken in account. They are the poets, the dancers, the painters, the musicians, the sculptors, all kinds of creative people are the truly religious people, but no religion accepts them as religious, because these people are functioning according to their nature, not according to any scripture. These people are almost part of the universe. One very rich woman asked Picasso, a great painter of our times, that you have never done any portrait, you have done so many beautiful paintings, but no portrait. My only desire is to have a portrait of myself made by you. And don't think about money. You say it and it will be given. The woman was super rich. Picasso wanted to tolerate her, but he could not tolerate the money. He was in immense need of money just for his paintings. He needed money, but he did not want to make a portrait, knowing perfectly well that when he starts painting, he forgets himself. So what comes out may not look like this woman. So he said to her that, listen, $10 million. She said, okay, start the work. He said, my God, I had asked 10 million just not to get involved in this work. I have to explain to you that when I start painting, I forget myself. The colors catch me so hard, their beauty becomes so immense that I don't know what I am doing. Just the painting starts painting itself. That's why I have never done a portrait. But if you insist, I will make an effort. And I cannot lose $10 million. But you have to make a promise to me. You cannot criticize my painting on any point. She said, agreed. The painting was done. The woman could not understand what is happening. Where she is in the painting, she could not find at all. It was a beautiful painting, great colors, very psychedelic, but it is not a portrait. And she has agreed not to criticize. So she said, I am not criticizing, just I want to know where my nose is. So from that point, I can figure out where I am. Picasso said, this is the difficulty. I had told you beforehand that when I paint, I forget. Now I don't know where your nose is. You take the painting and meditate over it. Sometimes you may find that this is your nose, and then figure out around it there may be some eyes, some mouth. The woman said, this is a strange kind of portrait that I have to figure out where my nose is. Once it happened, a rich man came and he wanted Picasso two paintings immediately. And he had only one painting ready. So he went in and cut the painting in two. The girlfriend who used to be with him, she said, what are you doing? He said, I cannot miss that customer. He is a rich man and he wants two paintings. I will make two paintings immediately. Anyway, nobody can find what the painting is, whether it is together or in two parts. And he made two paintings and he sold two paintings. Those who have purchased his paintings, even in great museums, find it difficult how to hang them. Which way up? Which way down? You can hang them any way, they are beautiful. But you cannot make any sense of that beauty. And another haiku by Basu for his morning tea. A monk sits down in utter silence, confronted by chrysanthemums. For his morning tea, a monk sits down in utter silence, because tea has become associated with Bodhidharma, who introduced Zen in China. He loved tea. And strangely, it helps you to be awake. Otherwise, sitting silently, one tends to fall asleep. So tea has become a special Zen thing. He is just depicting a picture. Under the tree of chrysanthemums, a monk sits in utter silence for his morning tea. Nothing is said. Just a silent monk waiting for his tea. These haikus are, as I said to you, paintings in words. A question by Manisa. Beloved Bhagwan, I would be dishonest if I did not say I also have been jealous. I have not always received from you with grace. I have wanted to be your favorite girl. I don't think I have acted on those feelings, but perhaps I have done in subtle ways. It is not that I only became aware of all this last night, or that by your pointing out certain things about Anando meant the rest of us were free of those same things. I know we all have the same failings. I know you know, but I just needed to say all this to you for my sake, if you will allow me, are further required. Manisha This has to be very clearly understood, that whatever I am saying to one person, everybody has to look within himself whether that is applicable to him also. I cannot talk to each of you differently. It is an impossibility. Every person to me is symbolic. What I said about Ananda is just symbolic. You all have to ponder over it. Perhaps the same tendencies, the same unconscious feelings, jealousies, greed, ambitions may be hiding in you. Most probably they are. Before enlightenment, you all have this barbarous mind. Ananda is not an exception. Neither Manisha, you are an exception. And it is perfectly okay. What is needed is an awareness that these things are within you. Nothing has to be done, just watch them and they will wash out. But what people do, they do something on the contrary. They repress them. They pretend that others may have jealousies, we don't have. They pretend that others may have anger, we don't have. They go on repressing all their ugliness in the unconscious. This is not going to be helpful in your awakening. These unconscious repressed desires, feelings, attitudes are all going to become a hindrance in your enlightenment. My effort in different ways, answering your question, are telling a joke, are talking about strange sutras of strange people, is simply to help you face your own repressed mind. Once you encounter it, then the only secret to be learned, which I teach every time, is to witness them. Don't do anything. Don't condemn them, otherwise they will immediately go deeper into the darkness of your unconscious mind. Don't condemn them. Don't appreciate them. Otherwise, they will become attached to your conscious mind. Don't make any judgment for or against. Just witness as if you have nothing to do with them. Witnessing is the greatest device that has been found by the whole past enlightened people, that it cuts through all rubbish just like a sharp sword. Don't get identified, just remain aloof and watch. Anger is there, take note of it and just watch how it arises, how it spreads like a mushroom, how it covers you like a blinding force, how it starts taking decisions for you, how you start acting according to it. Just watch and you will be surprised that it cannot do anything. As it will arise, it will not even go to the point of becoming a mushroom, because it can become a mushroom only by nourishment. By watching it, you have cut the very nourishment. It will arise a crippled anger which cannot stand up even, and soon it will disperse like mist. It has no reality except your identification. It is good of you, Manisha, that you have taken note of it. Ananda is also calming down. Here you are to become Buddhas, not stupid Buddhas. Because such a thing has never existed in the world, a stupid Buddha. Now it is Ananda's time. Princess Diana and Lady Fergie are the wives of Prince Charles and Prince Andrew of England. Soon after Fergie has arrived to live in the palace, Diana offers to take her on a bicycle tour of the London sights. Lady Fergie is delighted and they set off, pedaling through the palace gates. Diana knows all the shortcuts through the London traffic, and soon the two princes are bouncing along on their bicycles over the cobblestones in the small back streets. "Wow," Dee cries, Fergie, giggling and squealing, her ample body vibrating like jelly. "I have never come this way before. Really? Says D. I guess it must be cobblestones. Big Leroy, the black American football player, and Rabbi Saperstein, the Jew, are riding in a train together. It is a hot sunny day, and there are many flies lazily buzzing around the compartment. Suddenly a fly lands on the rabbi's sleeve and he brushes it off in disgust. A few moments later, another fly lands, but this time on Big Leroy's leg. The giant football star moves like lightning and grabs the fly between two of his huge black fingers. Leroy then slowly pulls off both the fly's wings and pops it into his mouth, chewing it contentedly. Soon afterwards, a fly lands on the Jew's sleeve again, but this time, instead of brushing it off, the rabbi grabs it between two of his long, bony fingers. He then slowly removes both of its wings, leans over to Leroy and says, "Wanna buy a fly?" Kowalski is out for a drive in the countryside in his new Chevrolet car. He stops on the top of a hill and gets out to admire the view. It is a beautiful, peaceful scene with a black horse and a white horse chomping grass in the field nearby. Satisfied and breathing a deep sigh, Kowalski gets back into his Chevy, but the car will not start. He gets out, walks around to the front of the car, opens the hood, and looks in dismay at the engine. He is wondering what to do when the white horse trots up, leans over the fence, sticks his head under the hood and says in a deep voice, "Your spark plugs need cleaning." Kowalski is shocked and terrified and runs off to the nearby farmhouse. He sees the farmer in the yard and rushes up to him. "My car has broken down," stammers Kowalski, "and one of your horses told me to clean the spark plugs." "Really?" replies the farmer. "Was it the black horse or the white one?" "The white one," guess Kowalski. "Pity," says the farmer. "The white one does not know a thing about cars." Dr. Breno is a world-famous shrink who specializes in secretly treating neurotic American politicians. It is a hopeless job, but he carries on anyway, One day, Senator Donald Dickstein, the 35-year-old Republican fundamentalist Christian, vegan lover, is sitting nervously in Dr. Breno's office. "What can I do for you?" Breno asks Donald. Donald looks around to make sure no one can hear him. Then in a quiet voice he says, "Doc, I'm not having any luck with women. I try to be cool. I try to be real hip cat. But I'm afraid that I'm a premature ejaculator. I always come too soon." "Well," says Breno, studying Donald closely, "when does this usually occur with the woman?" "Well," says Donald, looking around, "usually between hello and what is your sun sign?" Anando. Feel your body to be completely frozen. Now look inwards with great urgency, as if this is the last moment of your life. Deeper and deeper. Collect your whole consciousness as an arrow and go in search for your very source of life. There you will find the Buddha. Sitting silently, this is your real being. This moment you all have become Buddhas. To make it more clear, Nividano, relax. Watch your body as separate from you. Watch your mind as separate from you. You are just a witness. Just a mirror reflecting all that is around you. A Buddha is nothing but a mirror. From this point of being a Buddha, a witness, you can take another jump and dissolve yourself into the oceanic consciousness. Just within 2 steps, the journey is complete. Thousands of flowers are showering on you. Deep silence and immense space, utterly empty. But full of great potentialities. In this space you will find the truth, the meaning of life, the beauty of everything in existence, and the goodness of every being. Those who have come to this point will carry it around the clock, just hiding it behind their heartbeats. So you act like a Buddha. Eat when you are hungry, but don't think of anything else. When you are tired, go to sleep, but don't ponder about 1,000 worries. Each moment should be given your total consciousness, and you have come home. It is so peaceful. It is so blissful. This evening was already beautiful, but 10,000 Buddhas make it a miracle a magic moment if you are intelligent enough. You can make this moment a transformation of your whole life. Now gather all the flowers fragrance of this moment, you have to bring it back . Collect all the great pearls . You are at the very source of everything . Nivedana come back. But come back as a Buddha, witnessing silently, get up, sit down for a few moments, recollecting the space you have traveled. Recollecting the experience that you have encountered. This has to become your very life style. Not for a single moment be suspicious about your Buddhahood. Your Buddhahood is your nature. Act accordingly. The more you act accordingly, the more is the possibility of a growing trust in your being a Buddha. The more intelligent can instantly pass through the transformation. The old self dies away and a totally fresh new being is born, innocent. Okay, Manisha?
Yes, Bhagwan.
Can we celebrate the 10,000 Buddhas?
Yes, Bhagwan.